The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello there, everyone. Welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, as always, Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com, a product of Sea of Reeds Media. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. And we have an excellent show for you this week, as always. We're going to talk to Stephen Garrett about Queer, which is a new movie starring Daniel Craig. It's an interesting adaptation of a William S. Burroughs novella about, I guess, being a gay writer in Mexico in the late 1940s. There's also a lot of drug stuff in it. Very interesting film. A lot of fun to talk about, and Stephen will be along in a bit. But first, we're going to talk to Scott Gold, our contributor and sometimes substitute host for me. He is a big fan of the Dune franchise, and there's a new Dune TV show on HBO Max called Dune Prophecy, and I can't make heads or tails of it, but Scott is much smarter than I am, and he's going to be along right after this musical interlude to talk about it.
You wish to serve the great houses and shape the flow of power. You must first exert power over yourself.
The more influence our sisterhood gains, the more enemies we make.
There was a time when you took my view seriously.
Instead of allowing those sorceresses to woo you.
When I was a younger man, Dune was kind of a pop culture afterthought. It was a strange David Lynch movie from 1984, and it was a book or two or three books that I read and then discarded and then forgot about for many years. But now the second Dune movie is an Oscar contender, if not the actual Oscar winner. And we have a Dune TV show on Max, really on HBO. There's an HBO Dune series, and it's called Dune Prophecy. And our neighborhood Dune expert, Scott Gold, is here to inhale the spice with me. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Neil. Good to be back on the podcast. I have just folded space from the planet Ix.
What does that mean? Exactly. Because the thing I like talking about sci-fi with you, because like I watch the show and I kind of get the vibe. You know, but I don't really understand exactly what's going on in Dune. Is there a planet called Ix?
There is. That was actually a line from one of the super, super weird body horror space guild navigators from the David Lynch movie.
Ah, you see, there you go.
But yes, the Dune universe is vast and complicated and complex, and there are a lot of different factions vying for power, and that's kind of how the entire universe plays out over its entire existence. And one of the best things and most frustrating things about being a Dune fan is that there's just so much. There's so much politics. There's so much scrabbling for power, machinations, court dramas. And that's one of the biggest strong points of the series, is that we can really get into it in the way that we get into any other like high court drama. But also, you know, we have space stuff, which is also very cool. But there's a lot of stuff going on, which makes it really, really cool and exciting to see on screen, some of this stuff for the first time. And also, you know, just the format of a series is so much more conducive to this saga's universe because of these machinations taking hundreds or thousands of years. Like, you really can't get that across in like even a two-part movie. It just doesn't really work. So having the space to play with it, I think, is a really good call.
What confuses me is, right, there are family names that are the same in Dune Prophecy as there are in the Dune movies, you know, the Atreides, the Harkonnens, et cetera, et cetera. But it takes place 10,000 years before the Dune, when the technology and the clothing all looks pretty much the same. You know, so I just feel like That's a lot of years. Like, if you go back 10,000 years on Earth, people were worshiping Baal. You know what I mean? Like, the technology was not the same. It's not the same planet, really. So I just find it a little odd that that is the length of time we're dealing with. Not 200 years, not 20 years, not 500 years, 10,000 years. It just seems like a lot.
It is. 10,000 years is a very, very, very long time for humans. But, you know, if we're thinking in galactic terms and how long it, you know, might take for any species to go out, you know, in the known universe and, you know, set up different planets and, you know, cultivate fruit and learn how to live amongst the stars, then 10,000 years becomes less immediate because it's not tied into this one planet. Now, that said, it's a really, really good point that it's like the clothes are the same, the language is the same, the technology is basically identical to the Dune with Paul Atreides that we see in the movies and in the first Frank Herbert book. And so that can be a little confusing for people who are just picking up this series, thinking that it's contemporaneous with the Dune that we're all familiar with, and it takes place 10,000 years before. But there's a good reason for that, and it's explained in the show, is that not long, I think, just a matter of a couple of decades even, from when Dune Prophecy takes place was the big epic conclusion of the war against sentient machines, against, you know, your basic Terminator struggle against Skynet. The human race did that, but it took them like 1,000 years to even do that. Apparently, there was, you know, humans enslaved by the AI and they rebelled. And so we're just after that big anti-machine revolution. So the whole anti-machine sentiment and all of that kind of played up here, you know, in bits and bobs here and there. It's a really, really important thing to know about this universe. And because of the victory over the thinking machines, they kind of halted any other major technological process to the point where they really, like, they use, you know, knives and swords because they have shields that can block, you know, laser bolts or whatever, plasma rifles or whatever, you know, the scientific villains have. I mean, Frank Herbert set it up where it's a really amazingly intricate mix between very old, like primal technology and very, very like postmodern, like science fiction technology traveling between planets. And it's really cool. And also there's some almost like kind of, you know, supernatural, not even kind of, there are definite supernatural elements going on as well, as we see in the Bene Gesserit witches, which I don't even think are called the witches yet, but they're the focus of this series as we see the Bene Gesserit or the sisterhood kind of rise into power as consiglieres or consultants for the major houses of power.
But what they're really doing is manipulating history to their,
exactly,
whatever their sinister purposes are. They're really like not consiglieres. They're really just controlling events and are, you know, smarter and more sinister than they let on.
Oh, absolutely. And it's their way of, you know, because basically women can't or don't hold power in this universe. It's their way of just claiming it for themselves and steering to what they, you know, they believe they're steering the universe to a more peaceful, harmonious direction than if it were left kind of to itself, then, you know, people would fight amongst themselves until everybody was dead. So that's their take on it. Whether or not they're right is completely up in the air to anybody who's a fan of the series. But of course, everything, there's a lot of moral gray zone and relativity going on as well.
Now, there have been 4 episodes as we're talking. I've only seen 2 episodes of Dune Prophecy. And I got to say, you know, by the end of that second episode, I was pretty into it. You know, I felt like they really had to set up the conflicts well. There are no wooden performances. It's not boring. The first episode had its sort of snooze inducing moments, but that second episode you really started to see the sort of outlines of the drama taking place.
Yeah, I think they set it up really well, and you know, it could have, given the nature of this subject material, it could have turned out to be the most boring, just ponderous plotting plot ever. But they did a really smart job in focusing on a lot of the tensions, political tensions of the day caused by, you know, the sisterhood trying to work things in their direction. And then we have this, walking inciting event from Act One coming in as a man named Desmond Hart comes in to meet with the now emperor. And Desmond is a soldier from the Emperor's forces on Arrakis, where they mine the spice for space travel. And he has been swallowed by a sandworm and presumably pooped out with magical powers that he makes him extra special and talented at murdering people violently with his mind.
With his mind, he burns them from the inside. It's really quite horrible and disgusting. But it makes him he's an opponent. You know, he's a worthy adversary to the Bene Gesserit. He's immune to their charms, to their voice, to their manipulations. He sees through them, and they can't get to him. And I think I'm assuming that's going to end up being a problem for them.
Oh yeah, I think. First of all, Travis Fimmel, who you might have recognized from what was it called, Raised by Wolves, which is another great science fiction series that aired on Max. He's basically Space Rasputin. Like they are not hiding that at all, and I think that's great. And he's as you mentioned, he's a really worthy foil to Emily Watson's Valia Harkonnen, who's the reverend mother of the sisterhood, and her sister Tula is played by Olivia Williams, to more mature actresses who have really, really fantastic roles here. And I think they both do a fantastic job. And we also get some really talented actors playing their younger counterparts in the flashback scenes, which flesh out a lot of their family history with the Harkonnens, and also with their feud with the Atreides that, of course, turns very violent. Again, this is Dune. And it's just, it's a really compelling court drama, you know, mostly. Like, I see a lot of familiarity between this series and House of the Dragon, which is also a prequel series that was a little, people kind of snoozed on a little bit during the first season. And by the second season, it picked up and everybody's like really into it. So I think there's a really good chance that Dune Prophecy can follow that same success.
I think they're pretty similar. I think it's a good comparison. I actually loved House of the Dragon's first season, and I thought the second season, kind of just it was a buffer season to when things really pick up. But I feel like it has a similar vibe to it. And I mean, look, I'm not the world's biggest Dune fan. Like, I like my sci-fi with a little more swashbuckle and a little more humor than Dune gives us. You know, there aren't a lot of smiles to crack. You know, the colors are very dark. The matters are, it's a very serious franchise, right?
Oh yeah, it's borderline totally humorless.
Yeah, which you can't even say that about Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon. There's always some sort of like moment of levity, at least occasionally. But that said, I mean, you just as a entertainment product, right? You have to look at it and you feel like, you know, the budgets are huge, the effects are excellent, the music is foreboding and really good, and the performances are tremendous, you know, across the board. There's just excellent actors, and it's HBO, so there's lots of sex.
Oh yeah,
lots of hot sex.
Gotta throw in those late night HBO hoo-has.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like some Skinamax stuff going on. My wife watched episode 2 that has a super graphic sex scene. She was watching it with our 22-year-old son, and she said those are just some really uncomfortable minutes.
Oh, that's the one where they're in the brothel doing purple space cocaine, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, was it a brothel? I mean, isn't it? It was like two family. I don't know.
It was like kind of like a club, or maybe.
Well, there was that scene. There were sex scenes in the first couple. There's lots of sex. There are young horny people in this universe, and there, but the sort of central. It's good. It's good. It has a sort of a Shakespearean feel to it. Yeah, did I fall asleep during each of the first two episodes? For a couple of minutes. But I fall asleep during a lot of things these days, so it's not really a
Yeah, you bring up a couple of good points. The first one is, you know, this is the first Dune property where we're not spending any time, at least yet, on Dune.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. So all of the set pieces we're given right now, for the most part, are very kind of overcast at best, at worst, just dark and gloomy and foreboding, which kind of matches the tone of the narrative. And also we get some really beautiful, you know, very glamorous CG shots of Seleucus Secundus, which is the seat of the Imperium, where the Emperor's palace is. And those great big, you know, giant exterior shots are always really great in sci-fi shows like this to give you a sense of the scale. But yeah, it's other than that, like when it gets down to it, it's, you know, very character driven. It's very political. The thing that I also really love about this is that it really taps hard into the horror aspect of the series, which we haven't gotten a lot of yet, particularly with the training of the Sisterhood and the spice agony. And so we kind of go into their minds when they're, you know, going through this, you know, transformative drug trip, basically. And there are some really just deeply scary moments there, like just straight out of a horror movie, which as a horror fan, I really liked.
Like out of a, like something like out of a Ken Russell movie almost. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting, or just, you know, just like masked creepy ghosts clawing at people. And it, there's lots of that going on too. So, you know, it sounds to me like, look, you're a Dune head. I'm not really a Dune head. It sounds to me like the Dune people are really digging this.
Yeah. I mean, as a Dune person, I am totally digging this. You know, there are lots of really small hidden Easter eggs that only fans can get that are just so small that if you tell anybody else, it's just like, what the heck, how much of that spice have you been eating?
Man, I'm sure you would take any spice they would give you, I'm guessing. Right?
I don't know, man. I don't want to turn into a worm.
Is that what happens?
Eventually to Leto Atreides, the son of Paul, turns in God Emperor Dune, turns into a worm guy, god, and rules for like 2,000 years or something. Seriously, like Frank Herbert goes and does some really, 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 really weird things in the later novels, which is probably why it's smart that HBO decided to backtrack and go with a prequel for this instead of going forward, where it's like, how are we even going to film worm people and like, you know, chairs made out of what? Genetically engineered dogs.
Okay, so this is my question. Now that we get into this, you know, this is sci-fi, right? Where, other than people and worms, where are the aliens? Why aren't there like aliens anywhere? This is not Star Trek. Like, there's no fun other species. There's no other races in the galaxy that the people are competing with. What, do they ever explain that?
You know what? I'm not a big enough Dune fan to have a concrete answer to that, but that is the million-dollar question that a lot of people wonder, and I think the answer is the same as it is just contemporarily right now. It's just like, well, I guess they just haven't really found us yet, or if they have, they don't want to interfere.
Okay, well, I wouldn't want to mess with these people. They're a pain in the ass.
For sure.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So Dune Prophecy is on HBO Max now. It's on Max. It's on HBO, wherever you find though, you can get it on Disney Plus. You can subscribe to Disney Plus and watch this. So if you have the package, so it's there, and I'm gonna recommend it. Why not? Also watch it. Why not?
I say watch it.
Well, yeah, well, the thing is, like, my recommendation for all ills is just watch TV.
Just watch the TV.
We're only alive once, and God gave us TV. So, Scott Gold, thank you so much. May the spice be with you.
Always great to be here, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
The difficulty is to convince someone else he is really part of you. So what the hell?
I want to talk to you. Without speaking.
Stephen Garrett is back. He's in his garret right now, smoking a gitan, drinking brandy.
With a bottle of tequila nearby.
Yeah, you gotta have some tequila to go with your brandy.
Feeling melancholy.
Yeah, just feeling his age, really, like feeling his mortality, looking for some kind of way out. I'm talking to Stephen Garrett, but I'm also talking about this new movie from Luca Guadagnino, the director of Call Me By Your Name and Challengers. It's called Queer, and it is an adaptation of a William S. Burroughs novella, like something that Burroughs wrote toward the end of his life. And it stars Daniel Craig basically as William S. Burroughs.
And what was that? What was that novella called? What was the title?
It was called Queer. It was called Queer. And you know, what I liked about Queer, I liked a lot of things about Queer.
Oh, yeah.
Steven, you mentioned to me that it was one of your favorite movies of the year.
Oh, easily. Yeah. It's great. I just really love it.
And you're not queer.
I'm not, but I'm queer for queer, man. I think it's a beautifully made film.
Yes, agreed.
I think it's a beautifully made film, and I, you know, it's like I really love Luca Guadagnino. I've loved his movies for a long time, not some more than others, but I've never seen one that I've disliked. And they, you know, I think if there's a through line there, if there's a some sort of thematic continuity, it's about outsiders or people who feel disconnected from the world and are aching and longing for connection of some kind.
You know, and are horny as fuck.
They tend to be kind of horny, especially if they're queer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sex.
Daniel Craig, real horny in this movie. But what I there's a bunch of things I liked about Queer, but the thing that I really vibed on, you know, set in like the late 1940s, like post-World War II, 40s, early 50s in Mexico and South America. And what I found it very evocative of a time and place.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that I didn't quite expect.
Well, and I think it's also, and this is very Luca, you know, he's got a great sense of music and how to use music in films. And this, of course, is not using necessarily period, you know, appropriate music. You know, he starts off the whole
movie.
It's
a mix.
Yeah, but it's like that All Apologies by Sinead O'Connor.
Nirvana?
No, it's Sinead O'Connor's version of that at the beginning.
Right,
the
but then there is an actual, then there is a Nirvana
Come As You Are
song also.
Yep.
Come As You Are in the movie. And there are like sort of 90s songs mixed in with the sort of period music, but the actual like the mise-en-scène, right, as to use a term in French, is are they in Monterrey? Is that the city they're in?
I think it's supposed to be Mexico City, but it's an imagined version of Mexico City. You know, the whole thing was shot on location. It was shot in Chinatita, you know, the whole thing. So they, you know, it's all exterior sets and interior sets, all built in Italy, all shot in Rome. Nobody went to Mexico City, you know.
Right, but it was definitely like the neighborhood was kind of a set, but you got the sense of a city.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It was definitely like they were not in a small town, and you know, and then the second half of the movie, Daniel Craig's character and his sort of lover,
reluctant lover
guy who is mostly. Yeah. His guy is mostly blue-balling him because he's not actually queer. Then they go on a journey through South America to find some ayahuasca, essentially. Yeah. But even those scenes it was very evocative, like of like Ecuador and Panama and you know wherever they were roaming. And I just I had a very like strong sense of being transported. And in that sense, I felt like the movie was kind of based in realism. But then there's these surrealistic drug trip sequences.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's also a kind of surreal dream sequence too.
Yeah, yes. Drug fueled.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. Fair point. No. I mean, there's something. I think even shooting on these sets, it makes for a city that's not quite a city. That's almost like, you know, how like Kubrick shot on London sound stages for doubling as Greenwich Village in the most ridiculous way for Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
You know, and it initially bothered me, but then I was like, no, this whole movie is supposed to feel like a dream. It's very dreamlike and it's imagined and it's somebody's very subjective experience of that city. And I think this is that for Mexico City. It's very period specific to clothing and the furniture.
Yes.
And you know, the bottles of tequila and you know the men's muscle magazines.
Yes.
But there's some artifice there still, like when you walk into, you know, when they're in sleazy hotel rooms and the way the light, you know, the cinematography is lit in this rich oranges and reds, you know, and there's something just feels very fabricated and hallucinatory about it, which I love, and only the best way.
And it felt like to my mind, I've not read Queer, but I have read Burroughs, and it felt like a very good adaptation of William S. Burroughs. You know, it was like it kind of evoked the feeling of reading his prose.
We're kind of
wafting on this wave of, you know, nostalgia and repression, and also like, you know, it's all very fueled by drugs and sex and just weirdness. The whole thing is just so weird, and it's also kind of darkly funny in some places.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, but also, and correct me if I'm wrong, Burroughs wrote this in the late 40s, early 50s, but he didn't publish it until the early 80s or mid 80s, I think it came out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it has like that. It sort of feels nostalgic and also immediate at the same time. And which is why to me the ending of the movie, which is a bit controversial, and I won't reveal here, made some sense to me. Like it made some sense.
Yeah.
Like it narratively felt very accurate to his work. And so I really appreciated that. And also let's not deny Daniel Craig his props here. What a performance, my God.
Oh my God, what a performance. So this also, I mean, you brought Burroughs, of course, but he's kind of doing low-key Burroughs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that creaky drawl, you know, his strange way of talking, you know, it's
yes.
like, that's of course, I cannot cop to have read anything. I think I tried reading Naked Lunch, but otherwise I never read much Burroughs. But especially in the mid to late 80s, you know, he had a bit of a pop culture resurgence and he popped up a lot, so to speak. I think he was also hanging out with Kurt Cobain a lot too, right? In the early 90s. When did he die?
Yeah, as an old man, but this was like young Burroughs imagined. And let me ask you a question. So Jason Schwartzman is also in this movie, you know, playing a very rotund, bearded queer, you know.
Sweaty.
Sweaty, always has shit.
And full of longing.
Always has stuff in his beard. Really, really odd character.
Always has different shoes because his tricks always steal his boots or whatever.
I mean,
you know?
I mean, I was like, Jesus Christ, I've known so many people like this in my life. He's a weirdo bohemian. He's not necessarily gay, but like these types of people. And was he supposed to be Allen Ginsberg?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
He kind of looked like yeah, you know what I mean, like an Allen Ginsberg type. I also will say this, like. It seemed to me that in this version of Mexico City, everyone was either gay or a bartender or both.
Exactly.
Like there were no other types of people. There were like two women, you know. I was like the gays are all trying to find each other. I'm like, everyone is gay. Every single person in Mexico City was gay in 1948, unless they were like,
yeah.
like a street vendor or something, or a cabbie.
Well, and not only that, but it's and that subdivides. So you have older, wistful, mournful, longing gay men trying to find younger, very smoothly shaved
chickens,
perfect, like lean, you know, younger men who may or may not be gay, but are kind of open and sort of horny and. You know, curious about that lifestyle.
Smooth skin.
But they seem very, yeah, but they feel very generic. Like they don't seem to have any sort of emotion or opinion. I mean, this brings us to Allerton, right? Who's Drew Starkey's character, who is a bit, he's got a great line, Jason Schwartzman, you know, they're talking about, you know, like what a catch. And he's like, yeah, quite a catch, cold, slippery. And, you know, what is it? Hard to keep or something.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Allerton was, he's a real creep and he's like some kind of CIA spook on top of all that.
He is. Right. Yeah.
How nobody in the movie seemed to work. I really appreciate that.
Nobody seemed to work and you didn't really know. And clearly William Lee, which is the Daniel Craig character, the Burroughs,
had some money.
Just seems to have enough money to like live modestly, or maybe buy half a bar if he wanted to.
Yeah, everyone was like that, and I, you know, I admired that sort of vision of bohemia. All right, and so so I would say Stephen and I both recommend Queer quite strongly. You know, and I will say, how do you pronounce the Luca last name? How do you pronounce that last name? I say Guadagnino.
Luca. Well, I say it quickly, so I can kind of elide my mispronunciation, but Luca Guadagnino.
I mean, he also put out Challengers this year, which I think I liked more than you did. We talked about that, but what a 1-2 punch. I mean, just
really great
movies, you know. And Challengers is, I think, a little – I wouldn't take my grandma – first of all, my grandma is dead, but I wouldn't take my dead grandma to see either –
Yeah, you definitely shouldn't take her.
Either of those. You know, I wouldn't take – I mean, but you know, there are some – maybe some hip grandmas might like Challengers. There's some tennis in it. But, like, unless your grandma is, like, a very repressed, sad gay man – would not take your grandma to see Queer. It's a hard R. There's some like pretty graphic gay sex and there's a lot of weird drug stuff in it.
Right. But there's also, I mean, you didn't mention Leslie Manville at the end, the playing the weird shaman, the, you know, doctor in the forest or whatever, in the jungle.
Yeah, she was great. She was great. But, you know, that all kind of goes with the weird drug stuff too. I'm like, this is not a family film.
No, it's not. It's not. But I would say that of Luca's movies, this is probably the most heartfelt, the one that feels like it's most immediately, I wouldn't say biographical, but emotionally maybe confessional, the way that Call Me By Your Name was.
Maybe, certainly if he is a middle-aged man who sits at bars looking longingly at guys with tans, then yeah.
It's the mournfulness and the longing and the alienation. And I mean, you know what I thought was really interesting? You know, Lee is obsessed with the finding and taking ayahuasca, right? Because he wants, in his mind, he believes this is a drug that's all about telepathy. And somebody asked him at one point, why do you want telepathy? Like, why do you want to read minds? And so I'm curious to you, it seems to me that he wants to read minds because he is so desperate to connect with somebody that he sees ayahuasca, or at least the promise of telepathy, as a way of really getting more intimate with somebody else so that he feels like he can really belong with someone else.
Possibly. He does definitely seem to want a boyfriend, you know, as opposed to someone to just like have towel sex with or whatever. But I will say this too. You know, we're talking about the late 40s, like early 50s. This was not the golden age of hallucinogenics yet. So, people were not entirely sure exactly what these trips were going to do to them or for them.
Right.
So he may have just been delusional. You know, he may have just been like, you know, somebody might have thought that if they took a drug, they would be transported to outer space, or that they'd be able to travel through time, or, you know, it's one of those things. He just kind of thought that it would give him some kind of bizarre superpower. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, going back to what you're saying about Daniel Craig, maybe we should end with just talking about how wonderful Daniel Craig is in this movie. But I think Luca's previous movies have had young hunks or up and comers or hot things like Zendaya or whatever. It's very rare for him to have somebody, especially a man in their mid-40s, and have it be a story about that person, and have someone like Daniel Craig, who is basically James Bond, playing this sort of role. And I think it speaks not only to Daniel Craig being such a great actor, but also Luca getting more and more, I guess, coin in terms of working in Hollywood and getting bigger name actors and becoming maybe more mainstream, or at least finding mainstream people to help him tell these stories that are not mainstream. But, you know,
this is not a mainstream movie, Stephen. I don't know what you're saying. Challengers was the most mainstream movie.
That was the most mainstream. But I'm saying that these movies are, he's getting more and more into the bloodstream of Hollywood, which I think is fantastic. I'm really excited to see what he's going to work with next, because obviously people like Daniel Craig want to work with him. And Daniel Craig, to your point, is incredible. And I'm curious to see what happens in terms of awards and things and recognition he might get.
I think maybe he'd get more if this movie had been called For Your Thighs Only.
Ooh.
Hey, thank you very much. All right. So Queer is playing in cinemas now. Stephen Garrett, who is not queer. You may identify as queer. I don't know. I don't really care. Reviewed it for us on Book and Film.
My love for this movie identifies as queer. Yeah.
I just like a well-adapted book. And for a book that is this weird, to be adapted well is quite a filmmaking achievement.
Can I quickly say, do you mean well-adapted in the sense that it takes liberties and isn't completely faithful to the book, or just finds its own way?
It's just a good movie that is, it's not like a scene for scene adaptation, but it's a very, but it's faithful in the big picture. So it's just a really interesting film that, again, is not it's for everyone, but it was for me. I had a good time, sort of. Although, again, like, it's not quite as sad as All of Us Strangers, right? Which
That was the saddest
gay movie. But this is
that was the saddest gay movie.
This is still kind of a sad movie. But, you know, my wife and I rewatched like The Birdcage a couple of weeks ago, and like, I'm like, those guys were so fucking happy. They didn't have any they had problems, but they were like wacky, farcical problems. Like, they didn't have like real, you know, they were in committed relationships. They had fabulous clothes. They lived well. You know, they didn't have any of these, like, you know, neuroses.
If only we could all be gay in Miami in the 90s.
I'm just saying, like, there's kind of a genre of sad gay movies now, and this
I guess right so. Here. But it doesn't. I feel like to pigeonhole it. I mean, of course, it's a gay film, right? It's called Queer, and you know, but
it is a gay film.
But it doesn't feel like a niche movie. It feels like a movie that really universalizes these feelings of longing and connection.
It is a niche movie. It's an adaptation of a William S. Burroughs novel. That is niche. You know, this is not mainstream cinema, but it's still good. I'm not criticizing it in that sense, but I'm like, it's kind of niche. It's kind of arthousey, but I'd like to see Daniel Craig get some awards recognition for it because he was fabulous. All right, Stephen, I'm going to let you go back to your cigarettes and brandy, and I will talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. Queer is in cinemas now, and I guess it'll be on some streaming service at some time in the future. Daniel Craig is going to get a lot of awards attention for this role, so you will have an opportunity to see it if it tickles your fancy. Also, thanks to Scott Gold for talking to me about Dune Prophecy, which is currently running on Max, and that is available on an app, I guess. It's all an app now. Everything's an app. Life is an app. I am Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are always covering the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. And we will be back next week, as has been prophesized, to talk to you again.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.